Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. You can visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org to see all the other events that we have. But tonight, it's our great pleasure to have James Hogan here to speak on his book. I will say that when his publisher contacted me 8 months ago with this title, I said, that'll be perfect right after the election. And here we are. And the title is, of course, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse. Well, let me tell you a little bit about James's background. James Hogan founded the award-winning public relations firm Hogan & Associates. He has over three decades of experience in crisis and issues management for corporations, governments, and public institutions such as universities and hospitals. James is the author of three books, including the Canadian bestsellers Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming, and I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. He is a tireless advocate for ethics and honesty in public conversations and founded the influential website DeSmog, chosen as one of Time magazine's best blogs in 2011. He is past chair of the David Suzuki Foundation and has sat on numerous national and international boards and advisory committees. For a little civility, we have James Hogan tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'd just like to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to speak and all of you for coming out to listen. I'm a student of Marshall Gantz, who teaches at Kennedy School at Harvard, and he always expects people like me, who are standing in front of people like you, to explain why we are standing up here before we sort of launch into what it is we have to say. And so I wanted to just give a little bit more of an introduction. I grew up in Calgary, in this part of Calgary that's kind of on the wrong side of the tracks. It's called Bonass. And I never really thought, you know, when I was a kid, you know, poverty's not a great thing. But as I grew up, I went to law school. I did well at university. I built a very successful public relations firm, a corporate public relations firm. And so I'm not an anti-business guy. I'm very much a kind of pro-business person, actually. And law school for me was something that I just found boring, so I didn't practice law. I thought, you know, I taught skiing at Whistler for 25 years, and if I went to become a lawyer after law school, I would have basically not been able to do that. So I ended up just starting this PR firm while my wife and I were in law school, and it just kind of took off. It was quite a surprise to me. And so most of my adult life I've spent building a successful business. And, you know, it was always kind of a shock to me at the end of the month when I was writing, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 in salary checks to people that, you know, I grew up in Bonass on the wrong side of the tracks, and what the hell am I doing here? So it was always kind of a surprise to me that things went as well for me as they did. I felt that I was very lucky. But I always had this kind of sense of fairness that always the advice that I gave my clients was based on my feeling that people get the reputation they deserve. And that may not always be true, but it's a fairly wise way to look at the world because often it is true. And so if you don't want people thinking you're an SOB, the first thing you should do is not be an SOB. And simple, but not necessarily something that people come to really quickly. When I was in public relations, we won an award called the Silver Anvil Award for the best crisis communications program for a business in North America. And it was for a company that had a big health scare. It was owned by a bigger company called Wild Oats, which was later bought by Whole Foods. And they had a big hepatitis A outbreak, and we managed it, and were very successful in getting their business back on its feet very quickly. And when I was being hired, they were hiring me over the phone. And so, and all the senior management at this company that owned Capers, which was the name of the company, the senior management at Wild Oats, they were in Boulder, Colorado. I was in Vancouver. And so they were saying, well, you know, how would you help us with this? This was like the Thursday evening before Easter weekend, and they were all over the media. And they ended up being all over the media for a couple of months. And so they said, so what would you do that's different? And I knew, I was able to do a little bit of research, so I knew that most of these guys used to be senior management at Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream. So I knew that they would really care about doing the right thing, which I thought, good, they'll make it easier for me, do my job. So I said, what I would advise is, first, you do the right thing. Secondly, that you are seen to be doing the right thing, because you can't assume that communications is automatic. And then you don't want to get those two mixed up. And so that's always been my approach. When I stumbled onto the climate change problem, I really didn't know much about climate change. I was reading a book by a guy named Ross Gelbspan called Boiling Point. To show you how little I knew about climate change, I was in my friend's jet, private jet, flying to Dublin and reading this book, and where Ross Gelbspan was talking about these front groups that were being set up by the oil and gas industry that were being used to kind of create this climate change denial conversation and create doubt about whether or not climate science was real. And they had set up these, what we were calling, later called AstroTurf groups, fake grassroots groups, fake scientists, even fake scientific journals, to basically convince the public that there was a debate about climate change when there was none there. So this was a book that came out before Naomi Oreskes' book, Merchants of Doubt. Ours is a more sort of popular version of that Merchants of Doubt book, which our book was called Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming. Anyway, so my friend and I were reading this book, and I'm just reading about this corruption, and I thought, God, this is like outrageous. How do these people get away with this? And he was talking about this one guy. His name was Fred Singer. This guy was a very, very serious American physicist. He used to be the head of the National Academy of Sciences, and he was like a dyed-in-the-wool climate change denier. And he was out to try and convince people that climate change was a hoax and the science was just BS. And he had done something very similar for the tobacco industry. And so, and he wasn't doing any science. This was politics. So I just reading this, and it just made me furious. And I've often wondered where this comes from. Like, why don't I just let it pass? Why does it bug me more than other people when somebody butts in line in front of me? I have no idea. Al Gore a few weeks ago told me he thought it was those nuns in high school when I grew up in a Catholic high school, and maybe they did it, you know. And I thought, well, maybe it was law school. Maybe it was my undergraduate in philosophy. But whatever it is, I just have this kind of hair trigger kind of reaction to people cheating, you know. And so I said to, and my friend is exactly like me, except with a lot more money. And so I gave him the book. He's reading it. He owns this jet. And he said, well, what do you think we should do about it? And I said, I don't know. I'm just reading about these things called blogs in Fortune magazine. So this was like 2005. There weren't a lot of blogs around then. I said, they were talking about citizen journalism, and there's these things called blogs. So why don't we start a blog? So he poured a huge amount of money into this, and hundreds of thousands of dollars we put into this, and we started learning how to do a blog and how to organize a blog. And it became a very successful international blog on climate change. And as a result of that, work on the blog, after about 5 years, I wrote this book called Climate Cover-Up, and I went out to talk to people about climate change denial and all this kind of shenanigans and propaganda and so on. And it was a very successful book, but it didn't take very long for me to start feeling like I couldn't talk about this to people anymore, because people would come to talks and it would be like my message was, regardless of what I said, my message was, if you thought it was bad before you came here, just wait until I finish telling you what I've got to tell you, and then you're going to be even more depressed and feeling more hopeless. And I know enough about life that the last thing we need is to feel more hopeless about things. So after a while, I just couldn't do it anymore. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go out and talk to people who I admire about the state of public discourse. And so I started working on this book. I had no idea exactly what the book was going to look like. This is what it ended up looking like. So I interviewed, just to give you an idea, I interviewed Daniel Yankelovich, the great American dialogue guru, Roger Connor, who's a very interesting conflict resolution guy who teaches at Vanderbilt University. I interviewed Carol Tavris, who wrote Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me. She's an expert on cognitive dissonance and self-justification. I interview Jonathan Haidt, who writes, he's a moral psychologist, great TED Talk speaker. I interviewed Dan Kahan, who started something at Yale Law School called the Cultural Cognition Project. I interviewed George Lakoff, the great French philosopher and public intellectual Bruno Latour, Noam Chomsky, Alex Himmelfarb, who at one time was the clerk of the Privy Council in Canada, which is basically the highest ranking civil servant in the country that advises the Prime Minister and the Cabinet. Jason Stanley, who teaches propaganda at Yale Law School. Bryant Welch, who's from Mill Valley, who wrote a great book on gaslighting. He's just writing another book on fear. Really fascinating man. I'm having dinner with him tonight. Adam Kahane, Peter Senge, Otto Scharmer, Renny Lertzman, Paul Slovic, Marshall Gantz, Karen Armstrong, Thich Nhat Hanh, and the Dalai Lama. And it took me about 3.5 years, and I'm still trying to digest all of this. But I wanted to share a bit of that with you, and I'm going to just give you, I'll try and be as quick as I possibly can. But let me just start by saying something that Dan Kahan at Yale Law School said to me. When I was, for me, you know, a young, you know, someone who went to law school, a great law school in Canada, but not Yale. And sitting in his office at Yale Law School was really quite an overwhelming 2 hours of sort of, I started to think of it as my class at Yale. And this guy is one of the most frighteningly smart people I've ever met. Only at Yale do you have someone who's not only a lawyer and who's, you know, clerked at the Supreme Court of the United States, but he's also a sociologist with a PhD in sociology, and who's studying, you know, how is it that we can actually come up with good public policies and have healthy public debate when people decide alter evidence and facts to suit the cultural preferences of the group that they belong to. That's what cultural cognition is. So when we distort information to suit our social networks or our political affiliations, how do you actually create good public policy? How do you even have a conversation? And anyway, what he said was, just like we can pollute the natural environment, we can pollute the public square. We can pollute public conversations. And the public square is a public good that deserves to be treated with a kind of sacredness, just the same as the natural environment does. And this was 3 or 4 years ago. So now I just emailed him asking if he was going to be at AGU here next week. And, you know, saying, you know, I said, Dan, you must be really in demand right now. And he said, you have no idea the talks that he's giving around the world. So political speech today is no longer constrained by truth, by integrity, or even by sincerity. We live in a world today, in a world that's basically the politics of whatever it takes. And I'm not just referring to the presidential election. This is a problem that's going on from United Kingdom to Canada to Hungary to major countries, major democracies around the world. And it's not just kind of wild political rhetoric. I wanted to share an example of what I'm talking about so we don't just think about, you know, the federal election here. There's other parts of this that are happening all around us. My interest is environment, so this is an example that happened early in 2012. I was watching television, and this woman came on, very attractive, outgoing, very articulate, blonde woman, you know, very sort of Fox Newsy, which is quite unusual in Canada. It's sort of like a cross between Fox News and SNL, you know. And this is what she said. Ethical oil is like fair trade coffee or conflict-free diamonds. It burns the same as conflict oil in your gas tank, and it costs the same, but it's morally superior. And then she went on to argue that the Northern Gateway pipeline that was going to go from the tar sands in northern Alberta to the pristine coast of British Columbia was basically going to be transporting this ethical oil all around the world. And that there were foreign-funded radicals who were being funded by American business interests to interfere with a Canadian, a sovereign Canadian political decision, and that we should stop these foreign-funded radicals. And the weird thing about this was it was on all the major news shows, television news shows. And I thought, God, I've been in PR for 30 years. I had no idea it was this easy to manipulate these guys. I mean, this woman had the podium of the country for a week talking about these foreign-funded radicals. And so instead of the conversation, the public debate being about tankers on the coast of British Columbia or pipelines going over top of salmon streams and the impact it's going to have on coastal communities who didn't want it and First Nations communities who didn't want it and that interfering with their legal rights in Canada, you basically had this conversation about Canadian sovereignty. And so I was looking at this, and I have to tell you, I just, my jaw dropped. I didn't know what the hell to think. I mean, I've been in the PR business for a long time. I know what spin is, but this is something kind of beyond that. So, so after the week ended, all of a sudden the federal government, this time it was like a far-right federal government in 2012, the Harper government, started talking about this. And one of the senators, her name was Nicole Eaton, called these people foreign-funded radicals. And she charged them with political manipulation. She said, there's influence peddling. There's millions of dollars crossing the borders masquerading as charitable donations. Our Minister of Economic Development, Joe Oliver, said, environmentalists and other radical groups are threatening to hijack our regulatory system to achieve their radical ideological agenda. Pete, the government talked about money laundering. Senator Mike Duffy called environmentalists and these community leaders un-Canadian. Senator Don Plett said, where would environmentalists draw the line on where they receive money from? Would they take money from Al-Qaeda, Hamas, or the Taliban? So suddenly we had, you know, these sleeper cells of Ducks Unlimited popping up all across Canada. And this is something, you know, one of our great writers in Canada, Terry Glavin, wrote in the Ottawa Citizen that there was a whole shift in the narrative, but it was kind of a crazy shift. But yet, everybody was talking about it. Now, you don't have to look much further than the recent election here in the States or your Facebook feed or Twitter, the comments section of your local newspaper to see things that are kind of similar to this. So I think of this as kind of a metaphor. Don't think of this as about the environment or about pipelines or about climate change or about Canada. This is this style of public discourse, this style of rhetoric is popping up in various kinds of areas right across the United States, in democracies in Europe and Australia. And I think of it as sort of this combination of ad hominem attacks, so foreign-funded radicals. So what does that mean? So I interviewed Alex Himmelfarb, who I mentioned before, and Jason Stanley at Yale, who's just written a really great book called How Propaganda Works, very important book. And what they said, and this is an exact quote from Alex, the idea here, Jim, he said, is to minimize public spaces where dialogue might occur and where it does occur, confuse it and obscure it. The idea is to kill debate, not to foster it. The easiest thing for the anti-climate movement to do is spoil public spaces. They don't have to convince the public that climate change isn't real to limit public will. They just have to make it seem as if all the proponents for change are pursuing their own special interests and sow doubt that anybody is sincere or telling the whole truth. Everyone is just acting in their own interest. So it's like a war. It's not like an attempt to convince you that oil from the oil sands is ethical or, you know, coal from West Virginia is clean. It's basically a war on objectivity that's saying you can't believe anything that anybody's saying. Everybody's biased. There's no such thing as objectivity. And so when you can't believe anything that anybody says, why bother with the public square? So Deborah Tannen puts it this way. If there's a racket outside your house, you open up the windows to see what's going on. But if there's a ruckus every night, you batten down the hatches and shut it out. And this is one of the problems that so few people vote. It's because we have become convinced through various techniques like these ad hominem attacks, that the public square doesn't work. We've lost faith in social trust, in our general sense of trust of whether or not things actually work. Does anyone actually speak on behalf of the collective good? One of the ways, the other ways this happens is with what I think of as is tribalizing science, like taking a piece of scientific evidence and infusing it with a partisan meaning. So, actually, let me get to that in a minute. Let me talk about something else first. There was a fellow that I met. His name is Roger Connor. He talked about something called the advocacy trap. So this is a source of pollution that comes from well-meaning people. And he said the way it works is this, that so when somebody disagrees with what I feel strongly about in public, I see them as an adversary. And it doesn't take very long, because it's happening on the other side. So the other person who I disagree with also sees me as an adversary. And so we start to see each other as adversaries, and then we start to see each other as enemies. And this is particularly true when it's happening in the newspaper or in a very public way. So your intentions could be fantastic. You make an announcement, you and your group, about something that's really important, some important public initiative that should happen, and somebody comes out and criticizes you. Before long, you're starting to think, like, they're not just wrong, they're wrongdoers. And before you know it, it's like a battle between David and Goliath. But the problem is the other people think exactly the same thing. So you think that you're David and they're Goliath, and they think that they're David and you're Goliath, right? And so you end up in this situation. He calls it the advocacy trap, where you can't break out of the circle of blame. And what ends up happening is winning becomes more important than the issue that you started actually the debate on, right? So we have ad hominem attacks, the advocacy trap, and then this other problem of hyper-partisan meaning being infused into science. And you see this a lot with the whole climate change debate, right? So here I interviewed Jonathan Haidt and Dan Kahan. One of the things that Jonathan Haidt said was, "I'm right, you're wrong, let me tell you what you should think," is not a great communication strategy, because we all think we're right. And, you know, as Peter Senge said to me, it's a huge mistake to think that people are sitting around waiting for you to go tell them what to think. People are exactly the opposite of that. They don't like people telling them what to think. And so this attitude that we bring to the table, Haidt says that we are divided. People are divided by politics and religion, not because some people are good and others are evil, but because our minds were designed for groupish righteousness. And he says, morality both binds us and blinds us. Building communities is a good thing. He's also talking about the downside of it. Our righteous minds were designed by evolution to unite us into teams, divide us against other teams, and blind us to the truth. And Dan Kahan says the trouble starts when the public square becomes sort of infused with this problem where we start to look at certain kinds of information as the way people like us think. And if you don't think this way, you can't be one of us, you must be one of them. You know, it shouldn't be the case that whether or not you think climate change is a problem is mainly determined on whether or not you're a Republican or a Democrat. Climate doesn't care whether you're a Republican or a Democrat any more than gravity does. And yet, that's the way that these issues are starting to sort of unfold. So what ends up happening is you, And there's been a huge amount of research done by this cultural cognition project that finds that people, when information comes along to throw into question the beliefs of their group, don't change the beliefs of their group, they change the evidence that's confronting them. And it doesn't matter. The climate change deniers are every bit as scientifically literate as people who know that climate change is a problem. It doesn't even matter how well educated you are. In fact, some of the research shows that better educated people are worse at this. And so these are very powerful forces. Kahan's group even did this study where they looked. There's about 10% of people who present as mathematically superior to the rest of us. And so you give everybody a complicated math problem, and that 10% or 15% of people will actually figure it out in a different way than everybody else does. And so they did this study where they gave people data so they could and the data was on a skin cream and the results in this community on applying this, giving people this treatment. Nothing political about it. And so they were able to identify that 15% of the population. So then they did a similar type of thing, except it was on gun control. And what they found was that that 15% just shrunk because, and they were able to determine whether or not people would change their minds about the gun control data, climate change data, immunization data based on their cultural orientation. And they found that people who are mathematically literate in this way actually cheat themselves in order to protect the integrity of their group. So there are people like me. When I first started in public relations, I was in the business of helping my clients tell their message. So pretty simple in many ways. Be clear, be brief, be compelling, be truthful if you can, or as much as you can. But the idea was persuasion. That is no longer the case. People like me today work on ad hominem attacks. Like Noam Chomsky said, if you're losing an argument, shriek. Do anything you possibly can to avoid having to deal with an argument that you can't win. Call people names. This is a public relations technique that's used today to basically turn a real debate into a tribalized fight. And it's done through ad hominem attacks. It's done through these other sort of tribalizing techniques. And with the help of the advocacy trap, advocates, by being the other tribe, and sort of returning the favor of hating the people who disagree with you, can actually end up helping to create a greater pool of confusion and ignorance on these issues. This is a very, very serious thing. And anybody who thinks you just clear it up with facts has not been in the middle of it. How many of you know what I'm talking about? Right. I mean, it's a shocking thing that you can have like 97% of the world's atmospheric scientists losing a debate to people like Mark Morano, who knows nothing about climate science. He's just a really good political operative. People like him. So the guys with all the evidence and the women with all the evidence on one side, people with no science, no evidence on the other side, have a debate. The person who doesn't have the evidence prevails. It's a shocking, I think, just to me, a shocking thing. And anyway, I don't want to depress you so and do what I did with climate cover-up. No, but there is a way out of this. So I don't have a lot of time, but I'm just going to I'm going to give you, just tell you my encounter with three more people. So, or four more people. So I ran into Karen Armstrong, who won the TED Prize in 2008 and wrote a book called Charter for Compassion, looking at the TED people give you money, and she used it to pull all these religious leaders from around the world together to look at how we could overcome religious and tribal strife around the world. Anyway, she came to Vancouver and she was talking, and I thought, God, she could be talking about the environment, and she never mentioned climate change. She never mentioned the environment once. So I interviewed her, and she said, this is what she said, that in all of the conversations she had with all of these religious leaders, what she discovered was that all of these religions had the golden rule in common, that you don't do things to other people that you don't want them doing to you. Around the world, this is kind of the essence of our faith. She said, we must learn how to speak out against injustice, but not in a way that causes more hatred. Remember what St. Paul said. Charity takes no delight in the wrongdoing of others. And so I was kind of floored by this, and I was thinking, you know, this is... And then there were other people who said, you know, Carol Tavris said, hold your beliefs lightly, so that if evidence comes along that shows that you're wrong, that you can let it go without feeling like you're an idiot. Because we all try to self-justify. We all hate cognitive dissonance. It doesn't matter whether we're right or we're wrong. It's a bad habit. And so I was starting to think, okay, so we got to be nicer to each other, right? And I'm turn on TV, and Bill Moyers is interviewing Marshall Gantz, and Marshall Gantz says, I have no time for these people who think that there's too much polarization in the world. What we need is more polarization, not less polarization. The lack of polarization is what you get in a dictatorship, not in a democracy. What we need is more passion. What our problem is that we don't have public debates. At this time, I didn't realize this, but I did. I was shocked. I thought, oh God, here goes my book, right? And he was like a major part of my book. So I phoned him and I said, okay, I don't understand. And he said, you need to read Rabbi Hillel. So I said, well, who's Rabbi Hillel? And he said, well, Rabbi Hillel was alive around the time of Jesus, but he didn't have as good a marketing people. And what Rabbi Hillel said was there's two types of argument. There's argument for the sake of heaven, which helps us get to the bottom of things, and there's argument that's designed to demolish your opponent. Don't do that. So there's one type of debate. There's one type of polarization that's absolutely important, but there's another type of polarization that we have to be very, very careful about, because it creates this kind of unyielding one-sidedness that we find ourselves surrounded by today. So I thought, okay, fine. So I'm kind of still spinning a little bit, and I run into, and does anybody here know who Thich Nhat Hanh is? So Thich Nhat Hanh, this was an amazing thing for me. I get to meet Thich Nhat Hanh. I get this phone call saying, Thich Nhat Hanh would like you to publicize his visit to Vancouver. And I thought, what? I had been actually trying to go to a course that Thich Nhat Hanh was teaching forever. My wife and I just love Thich Nhat Hanh. And so I said, absolutely, but the only condition is that I can go to the course. And so it was such an easy job to publicize. You know, of course, I was doing it pro bono, but it was so easy because as soon as it was announced that he was going to be in Vancouver, it was totally sold out. And so 700 of us went to listen to him. A lot of the time it was like, I felt like he was having a personal conversation with me about anger. And and which I really needed. But before this, the course started, I get another call from his people, and they're saying he would like you to introduce him to David Suzuki, and he would like you to facilitate the conversation and have tea with him. So I thought, really? Okay. So we spent, David Suzuki and the mayor of Vancouver and I spent an afternoon with Thich Nhat Hanh, and he's a great environmentalist as well as a Zen master. And he has this way about him that is, I don't know if you've ever met anyone like this, who has this, I don't know what it is, I don't know how to explain it, but it's this this look that it sort of feels like he's like peering at your soul, and that he actually knows more about you than you do. And it's very unsettling. And so I was sitting, there was a bunch of TV cameras, and we were having this conversation. I was quite close to him, and he kept looking at me like that. And he said to David Suzuki, "You don't need to tell people that they're destroying the planet. They know they're destroying the planet. You need to deal with the despair. And the way you need to deal with the despair is by bringing meditation into your work on the environment." And so I thought, I found it kind of annoying that he said that, because it sounded like it was like, why don't you go just head off to the caves. So I said, "You're not saying that David Suzuki shouldn't be, or that environmentalists shouldn't be activists, are you? I mean, people expect us to be speaking up on behalf of the environment." And he looked at me and he said, "Speak the truth, but not to punish. Speak the truth, but not to punish." And I mean, I have to say, as I was walking off the stage, my wife said, "Oh, you heard what he said, right? Speak the truth, but not to punish." And I couldn't get this out of my mind. You know, it was just like, what the heck? And then after a while, I thought, oh my God, I've been given a Zen koan by Thich Nhat Hanh. You know, who the hell gets a Zen koan from Thich Nhat Hanh? And so, anyway, I'll tell you about that in a second. But I went all the way to Dharamsala to meet the Dalai Lama. Didn't realize. I wanted to talk to him about this WikiLeaks story that said that he was more concerned about climate change than he was about Beijing. And so I asked him that, you know, and he said, "Oh, yes, yes, he is, because the politics will change, but this change to the climate that he's worried about, it's, this is like the water tower of Asia, the third largest sheet of freshwater ice on the planet." I guess all ice is freshwater, right? But whatever, it's like, it's third from the poles, right? This is big, and all these major rivers flow from Tibet, so he's very concerned about it. So we had a great conversation, but right at the very end of the conversation, we're standing up, and the cameras go off, and then he reaches out like this and puts his finger on my forehead. And he said, "We like to think the Western mind is more sophisticated, but I think," in that, he said, "in Tibet, we go with the heart. And I think that's stronger. So maybe if we take the Western mind and the Tibetan heart and we pull them together, we can start to fix these problems." And so, I'm still learning and trying to absorb this. But I think, and I want to give you time for questions, but I do want, you know, people keep saying, "Well, what did you learn? What did you learn?" I mean, in a way, this is what I learned. This is, you know, each of these phrases or little quotes that I gave you here were 15,000 words long, you know, in an hour or an hour and a half of an interview. But I've been thinking about this. I mean, you don't get advice from the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh without sort of feeling a responsibility to actually think about it and to think deeply about it. And I believe, that it's my responsibility to assume that people who I strongly disagree with are well-intentioned. and not idiots. I may not always be right about that, but that's a good and a wise place to start. And I find myself, this is kind of that take the board out of your own eye before you work on the sliver in somebody else's, right? So, which Karn Armstrong says, look, don't think of these pieces of advice as dusty old religious things, that this was advice that was given by community leaders to people who lived in dangerous times, right? So, so I think about this seriously. Now, professionally, what I've learned from this book takes on a different form. We know from cognitive psychology that people process information in narratives, right? From the time that we sat around fires on the Serengeti, are storytellers. Stories give us meaning. The story of David and Goliath. There's no mystery that is still a powerful story. The story of Jesus, the story of Buddha. These stories are still part of what makes the human race a human race. And our stories tell us what's right and wrong. They tell us, they pass wisdom on to us. We tell stories to our children for these reasons. If we want change, we have to be better storytellers. And in these stories, we need to forget the idea that we're telling the story to inject information into somebody who needs to understand something differently. We are not at a point in the conversation where what people are going to do is understand more. We don't even have the space to have the conversations. So you can be talking till you're blue in the face to people who just don't want to listen to you because they don't trust you. They think that you're not one of them. And so compassion, or this warm-heartedness that the Dalai Lama talks about, this speaking the truth but not to punish, this deep, deep listening that Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, have become absolutely essential tools of change for anyone who's interested in making the world a more sensible and better place. Our narratives need to include stories that people can see themselves in. They need to be able to see themselves on this side and that side of the issue in our stories. They can't just be stories where we're the good guy and they're the bad guy, that we're right and they're idiots, even though we wouldn't say that. We can't imply that. The pluralistic storytelling is going to be right at the core of change in the future. And it has been in the past. That's what Gandhi did. That's what Martin Luther King did. This is what some of the great leaders in the human race have done, is they've learned how to have emotional dialogues where we can talk about deeply held shared values as we move towards common ground, where the solutions to these horrible problems that are stalking us all are buried under a pile of sort of adversarial rhetoric that we've been sucked into. Thank you.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to James Hogan speaking at the Commonwealth Club on the toxic state of public discourse. So we can only have polite questions.
My question, even though you didn't want to talk specifically about the United States, is the person who's widely considered most responsible for the decline of civility in this country we were hoping wouldn't have to hear much from after November, and we might have to hear from him a little bit longer. And so given that, what hope is there for a restoration of civility in this country?
So I think that realistically, we need to actually feel hope based on what it is we actually have the capacity to change. And I find it really difficult to even change myself, let alone improve all of you. And I don't say that to be superior, because I certainly don't feel superior. But I feel the same way you do about so many of these issues. But Donald Trump is the least of our problems. This problem is a problem that is taking place in communities around the planet. We do not know how to find and create this public space where we can constructively disagree. The idea isn't to get everybody to agree with us. The idea is just to find a place where we can disagree constructively. And just forget Donald Trump for a while. The reason why I didn't talk about him and I stuck to this original, because this is the kind of thing that's happening in a lot of places. And it's kind of crazy, and it can make you furious. I hate some of these people. I have to go meditate. I mean, some of it is just so horrible. You know, the lack of whatever, of understanding or whatever it is. But that is not the way through this. That's self-indulgent. And so I'm very hopeful, because the one thing that psychology and the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh and all of these people believe is that we can change. Now, we may not be able to change everybody, but at least we can start with us. And if we start with us, I mean, look at, I think, you know, I don't know if you know this, but we have this thing in Canada. It's called the Massey Lectures. It's a big deal if you speak at the Massey Lectures. Martin Luther King actually came up and spoke at the Massey Lectures in 1987. And he was in the midst, I think it was 87, but he was being attacked by stronger activists in the civil rights movement because of his peaceful way, you know, nonviolent and so on. There all has been this kind of conflict and these different models for change, but look at what he did. And you cannot tell me that he did not have to go through more than just biting his lip. That people do not get to that place. They do not get to that place within their own inner ecology without a hell of a lot of hard work. And so when I wrote this book, I thought I was writing about our problem, about the public square. I had no idea that Peter Senge said to me, the quality of any intervention is determined by the inner quality of the intervener. And these things, along with some of the other things I've told you, has kind of spun my head around. I didn't know I was writing a book about sort of inner development, well-meaning people can be making a mess of things just as much as the bad person is.
If you look back, can you think of a golden age of public discourse in which people talked? I mean, are we talking now about something that's always been, or was there a better time for this public discourse you're talking about?
Yeah. It's a very good question. And
I wonder if it isn't, you know, our wealth, actually, that is making us less cooperative with each other when we had to work to create enough to do other things. I mean, we talk about this great generation that came out of World War II and the Depression, and they worked together on projects. I'm sure we idealize that too much. But I think that there was at least a little bit more political dialogue as we were building up our wealth. But now that we're wealthy, maybe that's one of the reasons.
I mean, there have been many times in history where we have come together and we have worked through. One of the things that puzzles me is, but I look at a very small sliver of this. I'm mainly looking at the behavior of people like me in the public relations world. You know, the Karl Roves of the world, the people, the backroom guys like me. You have no idea how much of what you read in the newspaper comes through people like me. But that was back in the less harmful, more innocent days. But today, there's an edge to this and a kind of a divisiveness to this, of setting people against people. It's such a stretch, you know. And so I kind of feel like it's worse. But, you know, I'm not a historian, so I wouldn't want to get in an argument with one of those guys.
Just as a follow-up to this gentleman's comment, I understand today Al Gore had a meeting with Donald Trump, and he must have been reading your book and, you know, the other comments that he came after, and he said that he had talked with Donald Trump about the business imperatives that would come out of working on climate change, such as jobs, such as, you know, I guess jobs was his biggest concern. And, you know, so I think that some of the thinkers are already beginning to take that that track.
I just gave him I was the chair of Al Gore's climate project in Canada, and just spoke with him in Houston, and I gave him a copy of this, and I'm sure he's read it. I think he thinks it was like assault on reason, right? It's kind of like that. It was like his book, Assault on Reason, that he wrote after Inconvenient Truth. But I think it's being right is not enough. Being right is not going to necessarily come to the surface sometime in the future and sort everything out. I don't think. You know, so we all have these responsibilities to deeply listen to people and try to find the common ground before we find the differences, right? Hopefully, but I think developing these skills, we need to develop these skills. These are the skills that are needed in public discourse. And let me tell you, I went through 30 years as one of the top PR guys in Canada. I had not thought of any of this stuff. I'm so embarrassed by it. But it was, you know, I'm sure there are people down here who have been thinking about it for a long time. But it's not anything that we study.
I was going to ask you to talk a little more about what it looks like in real life. I mean, I heard you say, your answer to this gentleman seemed to indicate that you're really talking about grassroots, that you're really wanting people, you know, speaking to their friends, their family, among each other, to approach it in a different way when they're talking to someone they disagree with. Can you flesh it out a little more? I mean, I've had the experience of reconnecting with a friend from high school who, you know, we learned to love each other as high school students, and now I found out that she's on the other side of the aisle than I am, and that's like, whoa, such a shock. And I don't even, when we talked over, I'm from New Jersey, so I had gone back to New Jersey for Thanksgiving, and I in talking to her, it was like, I still want to love you, I do still love you, and I'm confused. And that was really a big motivation for me to come tonight.
Yeah, and I was, you know, in so many ways I'm reluctant to even, like, do things like this and come out and talk about my book because it raises so many questions that I don't have the answer to. But I've decided that I have to raise the questions anyway. You know, I just think the whole kind of science of science communication is in its infancy. We know more about climate change than we know about the science of science communication. Whether we're looking at gun control or we're looking at all these other sorts of issues like the, you know, destruction of oceans and ecosystems. And these are very serious things that are happening. It's panicky kind of things. Now, there are people, though, I don't know if you've ever heard of Bob Inglis, and this is a very good example. So Bob Inglis runs something called the Energy and Enterprise Institute. So Bob Inglis was a Republican senator who dared to say that climate change was a problem and then ended up losing his seat to a Tea Party guy. And he now he is has become an expert in talking to Republicans about climate change. And so he talks about things like free enterprise can deliver the innovation to solve climate change instead of status quo, ineffective subsidies and regulations, right? So it's changing the sort of narrative where you don't have to you don't have to deny that climate change is happening, but you need to be at least negotiating how you deal with it, right? You need to sort of open up. So I think that listening is, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, after he left Vancouver, was interviewed by Oprah Winfrey. And one of the questions that Oprah Winfrey asked him was, you know, I heard you talking about deep listening. What do you mean by deep listening? And he said, you go to the person that you're having a disagreement with and you say, I have realized that I haven't been listening. I care about you. We've been friends for a long time. And I want to listen. I really want to understand. I want to get a better understanding of this. And I realize that I've been at fault for not listening. And then you listen. And when you hear something that needs correcting, you don't correct. When you hear another thing that needs correcting, you don't correct. You leave the correcting for a later day, and you just listen. And if you can, you acknowledge what you've heard so that you can show the common ground and you can start to build the common ground. Because I guarantee you, all these people on the other side of these issues, on the other side of the aisle, are not evil. They're not idiots. They just are different. And we have been driven into these tribal groups. And so we won't allow ourselves to think certain more positive things about people. But you don't have to give up what's true and right to actually start to try to have this sort of interaction. It's just a thing we don't do, right? The world is really complicated. We don't have a lot of time to do this sort of stuff. But this is something we need to do because never in the United States have there been fewer Republicans with a Democratic kind of back-of-the-mind attitude or same on the other side. There's more and more pure Republicans and pure Democrats than there ever has been. The tribes are digging in. And the people in the middle who are talking about the issues that we're disagreeing on are basically driving that tribalism because it saves me so much time. I don't have to convince you that X is true and Y, and I don't have to go through the debate. I just have to convince you that this isn't something people like us believe. And if you believe this, you must be one of them. As soon as you have that, all open-mindedness shuts down. So that's why I think, however it's done, you know, somebody help me, please come along and write a better book than this. But you need to figure out, we need to figure out how it is that you create a narrative that sort of emerges from that as opposed to one that basically reinforces it, that I'm right and you're an idiot. Things won't work that way, even if it's true. Yeah. Otto Scharmer says, if you want to move beyond your own blind spots, open mind, open heart, open will.
An open mic. We have time for just one more question before we come to the end of the time.
Thank you. How do you think the fact that so much of what previously would have been private discourse happens now in a public forum, so such as social media, affects the adversarial tenor of so much discourse now, and how do we mitigate that?
Yeah. I mean, you've heard, everyone here probably has, you know, read or heard about this filter bubble problem, right, where you're, the algorithms and the search engines that we use sort of feed us information that is conducive to things we read in the past. So we very less and less do we get information. So Facebook, basically, the search engine on Facebook helps you find stuff that it knows that you'll agree with. And so you're never sort of challenged, right? So what ends up happening is there's this kind of tribalizing that happens just because of the algorithms in the news that we consume online. and Google's working on ways to get around that, but that isn't the worst of the problem. The worst of the problem is below that. The worst of the problem is confirmation bias, motivated reasoning, tribal behaviors that essentially have created this. The fact that it's actually public gives more opportunity to reinforce it. Because the more times that we can say, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm right, you're an idiot, the more you drive the tribes into the trenches and the less likely it is they're going to be open to any kind of conversation. So it's another tool, and it's a tool that everybody has right at their fingertips or, you know, like in their pocket. So it's worse. It's worse, but it's still part of these, you know, it comes from these human frailties. Are we going to let this other woman ask that question?
Thank you very much, James. Jim will be here to sign books, and if you want to ask questions afterwards, that'd be just great. But so ends another event in the Commonwealth Club's 114 years of enlightened discussion. Thank you very, very much for coming.